Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to listen. I do sincerely appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. It's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. Check us out at beekeepingfornewbies.com, the website. You can get a link there to the Discord room if you'd like to join us over there to kind of continue the discussion. We also have quite a few articles over on bestbeekeepinggear.com. The idea there, again, is to put out a place where we can do write-ups on a lot of commonly discussed things. No fees, it's all free of charge. There are some affiliate links in there, and I think I make roughly about 3 cents per $1,000 or something like that. But in all seriousness, if you want to go over there and check that out, there's a lot of information around some Varroa guides, a couple of different gear items, and we'll be continuing to update that over time. And of course, youtube.com/@beekeepingfornewbies. We do simulcast the podcast there. If you'd rather listen on YouTube, you can certainly do that. And we've got some other videos. I think last week we released the hardware cloth based entrance reducer. I did that both in long and short form. So if you can only focus for about 40 seconds, that's one option. The other one's probably like a minute and a half or a minute and 50, which still cracks me up. It's like a minute and 53 second video. And people, my average watch time is like 55 seconds. And I'm like, can you just give me that one extra minute? Anyway, that's kind of the nature of the YouTube world. As a reminder, when you join the Discord room, at the very top, you're only going to see one section, and it's going to say, read this first. So make sure you go in there, just read kind of the rules of the room, type yes, Y-E-S, you know, that you agree to the terms, and then we'll get you into the right group to where you can see everything else in the Discord room. And today's warm-up song is brought to you by Kansas, Dust in the Wind. All we are is dust in the wind. Today's episode is brought to you by Fancy Fortune Cookies. You can find them at fancyfortunecookies.com. So if you've never heard of this, it's one of the coolest things I've ever seen. So everybody eats fortune cookies. Like you can go to like a Chinese restaurant or whatever. They have like gone so next level on this. So the one thing that I think is really cool, they have like a giant fortune cookie. It's literally over a pound. It's 5 inches tall, 7 inches wide. I'm looking at the one that's the red, white, and blue as part of their like patriotic section there. But I think what I love the most about it is in this one, you get like a 1 foot long, like literally a 12 inch long customized message. So all of these things can be customized. And as a dad who loves to do like cheesy dad stuff, all I can think about is like, I'm going to order like a couple dozen of them. And whenever we get Chinese, I'm going to replace all of the classic regular ones with my custom ones. So whenever someone opens it up, it's like, oh, your dad is the best person ever. Like, I just have all kinds of just cheesy, typical dad kind of things. So that's all fun and well and good. And they do all those classic generic ones. But they also do like the corporate ones. If you wanted to send a corporate gift out to all your employees, like, hey, we appreciate you. We love you. You know, those types of things. They do branded logo type of things. You can get your corporate logo on the cookies. They've got all kinds of flavors like chocolate and strawberry and banana. It's one of the coolest things I've ever seen. So check them out at fancyfortunecookies.com. You can save 20% on your first custom fortune cookie order if you use the code BEEKEEPINGFORNEWBIES. Remember, it's N-E-W-B-E-E-S. And you can have all your friends buzzing about your awesome fortune cookies. Okay, now, moving on here today for the first kind of topic. I know there are some of you who have been patiently waiting for the yellow jacket wasp trap video that I've been talking about for a little while. This is kind of that time of year. Anytime it's robbing season, you know, it's not just robbing, you know, from other honeybees. You do have some other predatory kinds of insects that are going to stop by the hives and harass your ladies. And these traps are pretty easy to make. And I did get the trap made. And what I wanted to do in the video, it's going to end up being, again, like a 2-minute video. It's really short, simple, easy to do. And I wanted to have a, you know, here's how you make it video, and then me placing it outside, and then, hey, look, it's all full of, you know, yellow jackets, wasps, and things. The weather really, first off, it's been really, really nice. It's been like in the mid-70s, upper 70s for the past 5-6 days, which is unheard of. I can't remember in my life ever where I live having, you know, temperatures in the 70s in, you know, the first couple weeks of August. But I seem to notice more of an issue with the yellow jackets and the wasps. It seems to be like they're just more active when it's warmer out. But we've also had a lot of, there's like a coastal low sitting off the coast of the Carolinas and the Mid-Atlantic. And there's been a lot of cloud cover, some occasional showers and things. So I think that that's kind of decreased a little bit of the activity. Now, earlier in the season, I had some yellow jackets living in the ground in my yard, and I had found them like in an old root. There's like a rotting root that ran across a piece of the yard. And I ran over it multiple times with the mower. The first time I ran over it, I just recognized that I had hit the root and I really didn't pay that much attention. And then I was wondering what was flying kind of all around. They did not sting me, thank God. But I recognized, okay, there's something living there. So what I started doing is whenever I cut the grass, I would cut everything around that area, face the mower towards the house, and then just gun it and cut over it and just keep going and kind of look over my shoulder. And I could see, you know, the yellow jackets stirring all around and were pretty irritated. So that was my kind of go-to strategy to cut that portion of the grass. But I noticed on my last cut, they're gone. So the yellow jackets that were living in that particular hole are gone. There are some I know that were back behind the house. I'll have to kind of see if I can, you know, see anything still around over there. But completely unrelated, because as you know, I do have ADD and I can't keep track of a train of thought to save my life. If you remember earlier in the swarm season, and I was trying to catch when I had a feeling that the neighbor's hive was just bursting at the seams, and I'm like, that thing is going to swarm. And it did. And I had two swarm traps out. I had a lot of scout bees checking things out. They ultimately decided to go into this like 100 and some year old cedar tree at my house. The entrance to that tree is actually facing about southeast, which I thought was kind of interesting because I do like to kind of, you know, face a lot of hives in that direction. And I think that may have contributed to why they selected that site. And you can see the tangent going again. That's just another one. Anyway, I was wondering, you know, like, okay, they swarmed right before what we typically see as a period of dearth. And I thought, man, I don't know if they're going to make it. I'm really concerned for that small hive. Looked up there the other day, lots of activity. There's still a lot of movement. They're still outside guarding everything. And they're still making it happen, so that's great. And we'll have to kind of keep an eye on them. But anyway, I placed this trap out yesterday. And, of course, there were some flies that came fairly early. And I just kind of left it alone, and I didn't do anything with it today. I took a peek at it. Now, one thing I have found is the wasps and the yellow jackets, they really like that protein. So if you can find like particularly like a rotting type of protein, like if you went fishing and you had like some extra fish entrails that you could use, or anything that's, you know, that's protein and kind of smelly, what you can do is you can take the same trap. And again, it's a 2-liter bottle. You cut the top off, flip it upside down, almost like if you were making a fish trap. And you can run like a skewer through the middle of it and hang like a piece of, you know, like a fish head or something in there. And that scent will really serve as a great attractant for them. I've done that years ago and they were all over it. I didn't do that this time just because I know that if in the yard, like the raccoons are going to mess with it. I don't have it secured to anything to keep them from, you know, from tearing it apart and dragging it all over the yard. So we'll keep an eye on the trap as it is. If it doesn't work out, I'll take some advanced measures and we'll make sure that we see something. I did have one quick question, which is fairly relevant for most times of year, I would say, particularly in the spring when you're thinking about extracting honey early on, or if you wait until later, like at this time of year, and you're like, okay, we're coming up on the fall flow. I want to pull a little bit of honey off. But it's a pretty regular question that I get, and it's how much extractable honey can I get from a deep with 10 full frames? The kind of rule that I've semi-settled on, and it's very informal because of the fact that, you know, it depends on the hardware you're using. Are you using like a pine or a cypress, or, you know, different woods that you use to construct the hive, and the frames are going to have different densities and different weights. So your starting weight might be a little bit different. The honey itself is going to be potentially more or less dense depending on the forage. So I would expect that to be relatively marginal, but there could definitely be some differences in that. What I kind of target is like that 2/3 type of rule. So if you had, as you know, easy math, if you had 100 pounds of boxes, then figure you're probably getting, you know, 65, 68 pounds of honey out of that. Rough ballpark. If someone else has another system or another math way of doing things that they can come up with that they want to share, I'm all ears for that. But it's just simple math. You take the hive itself, the hive body, like a 10 frame hive body, and that's going to be somewhere like around 10 pounds or so. Frames are going to be about a pound a piece, puts you right around 20 pounds. So I guess that's going to be like your eight kilograms, maybe something like that, 8.5, maybe 9 kilograms on the metric side of things. And one kind of quick tip before we dive into the main discussion today, if you are planning to buy package bees and nukes and things in 2026, I recommend doing that early. There's a couple of reasons for that. One, there's a lot of places that, you know, they want to get some end of year revenue so they can book that revenue now. They can take down money that you send them today for this year's numbers, even though they haven't delivered a product and won't have to deliver it until next year. So it helps them. So they may be incentivized to try and sell at a better price this year for things that they don't have to deliver for another 6 or 7 or 8 months. So you might catch a better deal. The other thing too is, you know, there are some pretty reputable suppliers out there that sell out early. And it's not that other suppliers aren't good. A lot of them are just not as well known. So by getting in with those reputable ones that you already know about and locking in the pricing as early as possible, and you might even use that as negotiating power. If they're close to you, nearby, you might even be able to walk in and just say, hey, listen, man, you guys charged me $200 for the nuke last year. If I give you $200 right now, can I lock in that pricing for next year? Because I'm pretty sure prices are going to go up. But it's just like everything else. Everything else is continuing to go up. And I think one area it's really hitting small businesses is with insurance. To insure a business just keeps going up and up, and it's getting a little bit more ridiculous every day. So if you can find a way to lock in pricing early, that would not be a bad thing. I'm already locked in for five. I've got five packages on order. I would tell you exactly who I bought them from and why I bought them from them. But we had a discussion about partnering and doing some advertising, and they said that they did not need my help. So I won't mention who they are, but there are definitely some options out there, and you may want to lock them in sooner than later. Oh, and another thing that I have seen as well is the pricing, of course, will increase potentially going into January or February of next year. But also they do the whole like, hey, we're out of stock, sorry, you know, sign up here for a waiting list. And then they see that they got 50 or 100 people on a wait list. And then they bring out the next round that's, you know, $25 more than the last round or something like that. It seems like almost whatever you ask in pricing, people are going to pay it. When I started looking at the pricing this year for next year, I was like, I don't think I might be out. Like, I might be out of it altogether, because I can't believe what some places are charging now for packages. I mean, like, if someone said to me 2, 3, 5 years ago, like, hey, this is what it's going to cost, I would say, great, is that a 4 or a 5 frame nuke, right? I mean, the prices are definitely like nuke level prices. So I don't even know how that, I don't know. It's so cost prohibitive. I don't even know anymore what to say about that. Okay. So the main topic that I wanted to chat with everybody about today is, we have in a lot of places in the Northern Hemisphere, we have a inbound or about to happen kind of fall flow. And like for me, my early indicator is when my pollen.com alerts kick in and I start getting the alerts for ragweed. One, I know that I got to start taking Zyrtec because ragweed is one of those things that I'm allergic to. But it also reminds me like, okay, we should be getting a fall flow soon. And then you have to start thinking about kind of your strategy going into the winter. But I wanted to also make sure that a lot of you understand some of the biology that's going on in the background. And, you know, it's weird. It's this balancing act between keeping everything great for new beekeepers and yet also simultaneously challenging people. Because I think that if you come here and you listen and you hear nothing but like 101 basic level information, you're going to hit a point where you're like, okay, well, that was fun. Let me go somewhere else so I can get more advanced information. So trying to find that balance between, you know, easy, moderately difficult, more advanced kind of concepts, it's an interesting balance here. But we're going to dive just a little bit deeper on a couple of things. And I want to talk to you about what's going on with this, a typical fall flow and this ramp up. And then we'll also talk a little bit about the bees themselves and some of the physiological differences between, you know, spring, summer, and the fall. Eating healthy can feel like a chore sometimes, right? But I've found something that makes it easy and delicious. Washington Red Raspberries. These aren't just any frozen berries. They're grown by family farmers in Washington State, picked at peak ripeness and frozen within hours to lock in nutrients. We're talking fiber, antioxidants, vitamin C, real nutrition with no added sugar, just fruit as nature intended. I toss them into smoothies, stir them into yogurt, and even top my oatmeal with them. They're so fresh and full of flavor, I actually look forward to eating healthier. And honestly, it feels so good knowing I'm supporting American family farms every time I grab a bag, and you'll know they're grown right right here in the U.S. because it says so on the package. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at Costco, Kroger, Meijer, and Winco Foods. Look for them in Kirkland's Three Berry Blend, Smucker's Raspberry Jam, Peanut Butter and Raspberry Uncrustables, or those True Fruit chocolate-covered raspberries I can't stop snacking on. Want recipes, tips, or to see all the places you can find them? Go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. Now, what we typically would refer to as being like a summer bee or summer workers, these are going to be everything born in like the February, March time frame, all the way up until now. That's kind of everything that fits into sort of like that summer bees category. Now, they are really, really geared towards ramping up production, production of resources or gathering of resources, production of new brood, and everything is geared towards long-term storage of resources to make it through the winter. Your winter bees are, how can we keep everything nice and warm, protect our queen so that we're ready for next year? Now, on the surface, you're like, okay, well, that's fine. It's a honeybee. They can do a different job and they can fill a different role. And that's true. But it's important to understand what the differences are between the two sets of bees, because, you know, your summer bees, they're living anywhere between, you know, like 4 to 6 weeks. You might get 32, 36 days, you might see 42 to 50 days, but somewhere like in that, 4 to 6 week range is pretty normal. They emerge, they become nurse bees, they start making wax, doing other roles within the hive, become a guard bee, and walk out the door, become a forager, and then a week or 10 days later, maybe they're gone. That's it, their life is over. Whereas your winter bees, they are settling in for the long haul. And they got it. Their whole thing is, we got to preserve and conserve resources. We got to protect our queen. We got to keep everything nice and toasty to get to the spring. And not even to the spring, really. It's getting to the end of the winter, and we'll talk about that as well. Now, I'm going to go on a slight, tiny bit, but related tangent here. A lot of people think that the bees, they get really nervous, like at this time of year, or any time where all of a sudden there's a stop of production. They get really nervous, like, oh my God, I didn't see any eggs today. And I'm saying this not to pick on anybody. This is like literally me. That's what I freaked out. Like, there's no more eggs. Everything is over. I lost my queen. I killed my queen. Those are really, really common things to happen. But brood rearing has to have two critical components. They got to have it. You need to have protein. And this is going to be in the form of the pollen that is gathered, which is ultimately, it is then collected by the bees. They bring it back. They remove it from the pollen sacks, pass it to one another, or store it, whatever they need to do. And then, there are some enzymes that are added into that, which help make it into like your bee bread for your long-term storage. So that's going to cover you on the protein side. Honey or nectar will cover you on the carbs side, right? So you've got to have both of those. But this is an area with a lot of confusion, because people often view, like, if I'm going to go ahead and put a top feeder or a frame feeder or whatever kind of feeder on, they confuse that with being the same as honey. Well, they have 8 frames of honey. I don't need to feed them. Why would I give them a feeder or put a feeder in the hive when they have 8 or 10 frames of honey? But remember, that honey is, yes, it absolutely is carbs, but that's long-term storage to get them through the winter, to get them through tough times. Whereas that nectar that's actively coming in, that's a resource that can be used immediately for energy. So when you see those periods of dearth, where there is nothing else coming in, yeah, you have some carbs that are stored there, but you don't have that pollen. That tells them there's not a flow. There's not a need. Remember, honeybees go out and they gather. They bring things back. If there's nothing out there to gather, why do we create a whole bunch of gatherers who now need to eat? So colonies are really good about, holding steady, hunkering down, waiting, and being patient, and just consuming what they have and waiting for that next flow to kick in. And I love it for folks who are really fortunate to have a consistent flow. Like, I know that, my country bees down there, and I would call it not really coastal North Carolina, but definitely eastern North Carolina, there's great forage most of the season. We do have a little bit of some breaks in things, but they do exceptionally well. They ramp up really well early on, and they have sustainable things that just seem to pop up consistently throughout the summer and into the fall. But they do have about a 3-week period where things get a little interesting, but plenty of reserves on hand. Whereas again, at my house, it's like 6 to 8 weeks of nothing. It makes it pretty challenging to work with that. But if you let the bees kind of run with things, they usually do a really good job of managing it. Now, this is always challenging with like first year colonies because they have nothing. And that's, here we go, man. This ADD stuff is killing me. It's really hard to know exactly what to do with that brand new colony. One, you're a new beekeeper. You don't even know what you're doing yet. And then you're getting that mixed messaging. You never feed your bees. You always feed your bees. Only feed your bees if you're not feeding your bees. Like, it's just, it's a big mess. But when it's that first season, brand new bees, brand new beekeeper, I always tell people, when in doubt, feed, right? You're not going to hurt them. If you're giving them good quality feed, you know, you're getting them the nutrition that they need. You're supplementing with, you know, a good balanced amino acid kind of supplement that gets them all the things they need. They can be fine. They can do well. They can thrive. They can be successful, happy. You may end up, you know, storing away more resources than they need. They may have a bigger, larger cluster than they need for that, you know, the conditions of that environment for that particular race of bees. All of those things are possible. But I would rather be in a situation where we had more and too much than less and not enough. But when you have an established colony, they are really, really great at managing these things on their own. The challenges always come in when the beekeepers decide, I think I'm going to take this much honey or that much honey. That's when things become challenging, is when we start taking from them, then they don't have enough. Then figuring out what that balance looks like. But anyway, so your spring bees, summer bees, like they're just boom, 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 constantly going, gathering, bring it back, gather, bring it back, burn out, die. More bees replace them, and it just keeps going in that cycle. Your winter bees are different. These are bees that are, they're hatching in, you know, late summer, maybe even early fall. And they're getting the nature, the environment and nature is providing them with like a different set of resources. So all the things you see that are in bloom that are providing feed for them in the spring, you're seeing completely different things in that fall timeframe. So for us, you know, we end up with, you know, like your goldenrod and asters, sunflowers, smartweed. There's a lot of different things that are going to pop up in the fall that have a different kind of protein, amino acid type profile to them. And what you're doing now is you're getting the bees, they're focusing on being able to pack on a lot of fat. You know, they're getting fat, they're getting protein as well, but they're really packing on a lot more fat, this rich nutrient dense, you know, pollen and these resources they're bringing in. They're trying to pack on more kind of fat bodies to allow them to have more resources to overwinter. So recognizing that, you know, the composition, the protein and fat kind of composition of different things is very different. This is, again, why we always talk about the diversity in forage. I mean, you can have some things that have maybe, you know, as low as 2% protein, and some things might be as high as 60%, or fat levels of those things that they're consuming could be around 1% or even up to as much as 15%. But when the bees have access to, you know, multiple sources to forage from, that more diverse forage, they definitely get a better balance of those amino acids, those essential amino acids, as well as the lipids and things that help them build up and store, you know, for long term to get through the winter. To kind of wrap up the high level of that section there, what I would say is, if you are buying supplement, because there are sometimes, that is not the most unusual thing, where you'll have a really weak, or what we would just basically call a terrible fall flow. A lot of times weather can do that. You know, we've got, there's an active hurricane, I think, working right now out in the Atlantic. You get a bad hurricane come through, it can really be damaging to a lot of the fall, you know, forage that's out there. So a bad fall flow can really set the bees up for failure. So if you end up needing to feed, this is definitely like a 2-to-1 kind of area. So, you know, 2 parts sugar to 1 part water, definitely would pay attention to that. But I would say that if you are feeding and you are going to add any kind of a protein supplement, if you ended up giving a mix that was a spring mix and had all these great spring proteins and things in there, that's still going to be better than giving them nothing or them having nothing. If you have the ability to find something that is like a fall winter mix, that's what I would be looking towards if you were going to do a protein or pollen based substitute. Now, I want to talk kind of briefly about cluster size. When I say cluster size, I mean you have your bee boxes in whatever configuration they are. The bees will form, if you imagine a swarm in a tree, anytime you've ever seen a swarm hanging from a tree, cut that picture out and drop it right in the middle of your hive. That's what I'm talking about when I say cluster. And I love all the information and all the thoughts and the ideas that everybody has about this. people will broadly tell you a lot of things in beekeeping, which just drives me to drink. It drives me insane. What works here at my house doesn't necessarily work at your house. What works for one, you know, race of bees may not work for another. I mean, broadly, like a bee is a bee, and they should behave relatively the same for a lot of things. But you can't just tell people this is the way you do things. Like there was a comment the other day. I didn't say anything about it. But there was a comment the other day where it was like, oh, you got to have a big cluster size. And it's like, well, no, you kind of don't, actually. You've got to have balance. Balance is what you have to have. And that balance doesn't happen really overnight. It's not like you just, you know, wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a beekeeper. You throw a bunch of bees in a box, feed the heck out of them, and then say, I have balance. Like, the bees will take care of it on their own. Little asterisk on that is, if bees are meant to be in your area at all, keeping in mind that honeybees are not native to North America, we brought them here. But if you are in an area that supports honeybees, that has the forage, that has the resources necessary for them to be successful, your best bet outside of maintaining IPM, your integrated pest management strategy, treating for Varroa, treating for anything else that comes up from a health standpoint, outside of that, leave them alone. They are very good at finding what they need, storing it away, managing the amount of brood they need to survive. But people get the mindset. And like I've said before, if you said, I'm going to be doing pollination out in California with the almonds in February, then yeah, you absolutely have to have a big ramp up at the end of the fall so that you have a big cluster of winter bees to take out there who will then be the bees you're using to kick things off on that almond pollination. That makes sense. Regular hobbyist beekeeper at home, it's not, I need to make a really big cluster of bees with three deep hive bodies fully packed. You don't have to have that. You need what's right for your bees. So for example, like Russian bees, they will shut brood down a little bit earlier. They overwinter in a smaller cluster. They're very frugal kind of in the way that they manage their stored resources. They can definitely appear pretty, you know, weak in late winter, but they rebound very quickly as soon as forage returns. Now, there are some disadvantages to Russians, which we can talk about in another, you know, another discussion or another time. But that's just one example. That Carniolans, they tend to be pretty good about conserving their resources as well. And they throttle brood production in dearths just like others do. They're very good, you know, for long winters. Italians are more likely to keep the brood going kind of later into the fall. They maintain a larger cluster typically. And they can also, you know, burn through some resources a little bit faster in cooler climates. Right, all of them kind of behave and handle things just a little bit differently. So to broadly say you have to have a big cluster, or, oh, I always feed from August through October to make sure I have a huge cluster. You can do that and it can give you success. But remember, just because something was successful doesn't mean it makes a difference. And I gave an example the other day, and it was probably, I don't know, I come up with weird examples. But it's like if you go outside and you do an inspection and you take really good care of your hive all season, and at the end of every inspection, you stand on one foot and do like the breathalyzer test where you touch your nose 15 or 20 times. And at the end of the season, you're like, wow, man, my bees survived a whole year. Everything is great. I did it. And it was because at the end of every inspection, I stood on one foot and touched my nose 20 times. No, that's anecdotal. Like, yes, you physically touched your nose 20 times in the DUI assessment position, but that has nothing to do with it, right? So there's just, it frustrates me to no end of all the things that people say that you have to do, right? It's like the whole thing with the candy boards and the fondant and all this stuff that you have to do. Okay, well, if you have to do it, now, like, I don't have bees at the house this year, but for, I don't know what it is, like 13 consecutive, like 2 years in a row, I used fondant because all the great beekeeping advice of the world said you have to put fondant or something in the hives every year. I was flipping out trying to find fondant that I could get into my hives, put it in 2 years in a row. It did not have any impact in my bees' survivability. I have not put fondant in a beehive since I think it was the winter of 2014 into 2015. So in the past 10, 11 years, like what magic am I working on my hives? What sorcery am I doing that allows my beehives to survive over winter, for my bees to not starve, and for them to thrive and be happy and successful and all? What am I doing differently? I never, ever put granulated sugar, candy boards, or any of that fondant. None of that stuff goes into my hives. And the only exception I've said many times is, you know, you pop in, take a peek at the hive in February, and you're like, oh, yeah, they're up here near the top. They're getting a little low. Maybe you throw a pollen patty on, right, to help them out, because they are at the end of the winter. They are going to start ramping up brood in preparation for the spring. That is really going to rapidly deplete some of those last remaining resources. Makes sense if they're a little bit light like that. But I mean, I hear people then in colder climates that are like, oh, every time it breaks 45 degrees all winter long, I'm in the hive taking a look. It's like, no, no, just focus on your genetics. Focus on letting the bees be bees. Focus on not taking everything away from them and then figuring out how to replace it. I always have surplus. Like, my bees will make a bunch of honey. They keep the honey. And then in the spring, I'm like, oh, cool, there's four leftover frames. And then as they ramp up and fill a super, I can go ahead and pull a couple frames for myself, or I can go and use that to make another nuke and just build up. You don't have to constantly be taking from them and then wondering why you've got to put all this supplement, all this crap into them. Like, yes, it is more expensive by dollar. Like, when you look at how much it cost to go and buy, let's say, a pound of honey versus buying some sugar feeds and some other things. But you can absolutely have surplus, and your bees can survive and overwinter and be successful without all this crap. I just think that this whole overwinter feeding thing introduces a lot of challenges, because I've watched people in videos. Like, I had somebody message me the other day, and they were like, hey, I'm really concerned. I'm confused because I'm hearing that I've got to put this and this and this in my hive. I've got to do that. I've got to be feeding pollen patties all year. And I'm not picking on the guys who, I'll give an example, Cayman Reynolds, right? I haven't watched a whole lot of his videos, but I've watched like four or five of them. Very competent guy, very capable guy. And you'll see him in his bee yard, and he's dropping pollen patties and he's doing stuff. But why? He's doing it for a very specific purpose. He's like, hey, I just split these colonies. I'm making nukes. I'm expanding. If you are expanding and growing, you're going to need to feed the bees. It's as simple as that. And it may not be a lot. It might be just enough to get them over the hump, you know, until the flow really kicks in or whatever's going on. When you're in these rapid expansion modes, like him and Bob Binney and some of these other great beekeepers in the community are doing, David Burns, right? A lot of smart people out in the community. And you'll see them like, why are these guys constantly feeding the bees? They're doing it because they are constantly growing and expanding to meet the demand of the people who want to buy bees from them. And in order to do that, they have to have something that they're feeding them. Now, my approach is a little bit different. When I'm expanding, I just take surplus from the bees and I use that to support the growth of the new bees. And then in the summer, I'll do, you know, typically a lot of open feeders and things. It depends on what's going on. If it gets into a dearth time period, I'll just kind of focus. Well, I don't want to go off on this tangent because there's other components to that to keep in mind and to consider as well. But again, you'll see these people who have very specific goals that are unique, and they are different from your goals. Your goals are just to survive. And I just want to get them through the winter or get them through the summer. Hopefully they don't get robbed out. Hopefully they store enough resources to overwinter and I can have bees again in the spring. Their goals and objectives are very different from yours. So just be mindful that just because you see somebody saying, this is what I'm doing, this is what I always do, and this is why I do it, make sure that their why is in line with your why. And I also strongly recommend that you use multiple sources for everything. It's unfortunate, but I can't even go into a bee farm anymore. Like, I go into a bee farm and I'm frustrated within like 5 minutes. I saw one the other day and it was just, I'm not even going to talk about it. It's going to make me just have a meltdown here. Okay. To wrap up the section for today, you know, bees, when they breed, they don't have, you know, lungs like you and I do, right? They breathe through these things called spiracles that are along their body, and it connects into like a tracheal system, and that's what moves oxygen directly into the tissues. They've got hemolymph and we have blood. It's a little bit of a different way of doing things, but I want you to be aware that in the winter, CO2 levels inside the hive, inside that cluster, they're naturally going to run, you know, a little higher than they are in the summer. Again, CO2, so carbon dioxide. It's normal for a healthy winter colony. Obviously, fresh air is still important, so you still need to have an entrance that's open. You don't really, suffocation is something that people kind of get concerned about. They want to make the hive a lot like, and which we'll talk about this as we prepare for overwintering episodes coming up soon, but they want to, you know, wrap the hive completely, you know, airtight, just like they would for their home. We don't want to go quite that far. You do want to have an entrance open. You do need to have some fresh air coming in. If you are in an area that is not necessarily prone to snow, but you get some snow, might want to step outside and just wipe off that entrance and make sure that you still have air coming in and out of the hive just to give them some fresh air. Like I said, a little bit of an increase in the CO2 levels is not unusual in the wintertime at all. If you are in an area that is really, really snow prone, which is weird to be talking about snow here on August 11th, but if you're in an area that's really snow prone, you may want to consider bringing in that top entrance. This is the only scenario that I would advocate for a top entrance, is if you're in an area where you might end up getting 2 or 3 feet of snow that sits around for a long time, having that top entrance allows them to have some fresh air coming in. It gives them a way to get out if it gets warm enough for them to do a cleansing flight. It allows them to be able to get out and do so. That would be the only scenario where I would recommend a upper entrance. It's just more for them to defend, a great source and entry point for robbing. So we've talked about that before. All right, folks. Well, the ADD is pretty strong today, so I gotta pull the reins here and get settled down here. This is a pretty busy week. We've got a wedding this week. We've got a lot of things going on. You're not going to hear a whole lot from me, I don't think. I say that, and then it's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm online because I can't sleep. But anyway, hopefully that wraps everything up. If you have any questions about this or if I missed anything, as always, drop me an email. Join the Discord room. Let us know what your thoughts are on things. And don't hesitate to send over a question. I do my best to get back to them within a couple of days. If you are one of our Buy Me a Coffee supporters, obviously you're getting 24-hour responses on anything. And thank you again to all you folks who support through Buy Me a Coffee. If you found any value in anything that you're hearing, seeing, or reading coming from me, feel free to buy me a cup of coffee. I do appreciate it. Link is in the description. Don't forget to check out beekeepingfornewbies.com. Discord link is in there. Bestbeekeepinggear.com. YouTube.com/@beekeepingfornewbies. And outside of that, that's all I've got. Take care. Be kind to one another. Remember that I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.